Off the Ball
on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Wales and Denmark, everyone. They ain't going away. More of that to come.
You cursed that last night because you said that.
Huh. Well, you gave us... What's the other one you gave us? You said Wales.
I said Wales, Northern Ireland, but
you
I wanted.
You give us Denmark.
He wants Denmark, yeah.
Well, we've got him. Wales and Denmark are coming back to town. So the Nations League draw took place today in Switzerland. Dan McDonald will join us. He was over there speaking to Martin O'Neill and speaking presumably to the Welsh and Danish journalists, getting their reaction to the whole thing. And he'll explain how it works. If you caught the football show last night, you'll know how the whole thing works. But if you didn't, then Dan will explain.
Ah, you're a shower, aren't you?
One of the great quiz questions in Irish sport is who is the most successful Irish tennis player of all time? The answer is Mabel Cahill, who comes from Ballyragget, County Kilkenny. She had Ballyragget on the map long before the exploits of 2017. Five US Opens to her name in the 1890s. Professor Paul Rouse from UCD will come to studio and talk to us about Mabel Cahill, an extraordinary life as well, which didn't end well, unfortunately, for her. We have Keith and Liam Toland on Wednesday Night Rugby, and we'll also talk to Louise Taylor from The Guardian about Phil Neville. Oh, Phil, who seems to have got himself in all sorts of trouble. So we'll talk to Dan McDonald from Switzerland around 25 past seven or so. Initial thoughts, though, Kev, on Denmark and Wales. Certainly, you would think the fact that there's a bit of recent history and the Ryan Giggs factor makes it all palatable enough, kind of interesting.
Well, there'll be one thing I spoke about last night. You want a bit of bite in the games. That's why I would have preferred Northern Ireland and Wales to be in the group. So the history that we've got with Denmark, there has to be bite in that one. There has to be some sort of revenge in the players' minds going into that one. It has to be certainly at the forefront. So yeah, I'm quite happy with it. It's not the worst places we've got. I think the supporters as well are not travelling. You know, they've not got too lengthy flights to get into Denmark, and it probably will be in Copenhagen. Although Nathan again might take us to Malmo, as we know, different country. But yeah, it'd be good. I think they're good ties.
And there's going to be promotion and relegation in this group of three.
Yeah,
I mean, are we bottom seeds of those two? I know we beat Wales and Cardiff.
We probably will be, wouldn't we, Rich? That maybe I'd say we will be. It's irrelevant, though, isn't it?
But I mean, in your mind, like if you were doing the odds, Denmark should top the group again based on what we saw.
Yes. Yeah. They'd be favourites, yeah. They'll be favourites. Wales.
So dozen Wales in a fight out.
Yeah, I say for relegation, yeah. I think you probably... Yeah, you're right from that. That's how the bookies will have it. But there's a good chance for us to get into the top. I think Nathan was pointing out today, there's a great chance for us that if we do get promoted, then... Of course, then we get a better seeding for the Euros and for the World Cup.
Yeah, that's the thing. So seedings for the Euro 2020 are at stake here. You can obviously get into a Euro 2020 playoff as well, but we won't get too into how that...
Could you explain how, Joe?
No. Football show last night, Kevin Kilman went through all the various permutations. Ooh. Interestingly, there are no FIFA rankings, but there are caps handed out if you appear for the country, but FIFA rankings won't be affected. Which is odd, considering friendlies would have affected your rankings.
Yeah, I don't understand that. Honestly, there's a lot of complication around this, Rich, as you know.
There's a lot about this tournament.
And I made it even more complicated, as we all know.
Just by talking.
But, yeah, that's true. But, yeah, I don't understand that. Strange. Why not? You're still playing a competitive international game. Sorry, you're still playing an international game, not necessarily competitive.
Well, it is a competitive international game from the point of view of caps. Like we saw before that we were, you know, had to cap players in competitive qualifiers to make sure that they wouldn't declare elsewhere.
Yeah.
So obviously we've seen the talk about Michael Obafemi and even Declan Rice that they might declare elsewhere.
But they can actually play in these and then go and play for another country. That's still the case.
No, the FIFA have clarified today that the Nations League will count as competitive games.
You do get a cap.
But you do get a cap, yeah.
No, you'll get a cap.
You get a cap regardless. But
you get a cap, but the old system was if you played at friendly, like Diego Costa played for Brazil in a friendly but still played for Spain.
That's a fair point, yeah.
So that's the thing, but obviously Alex Rich is saying that.
Yeah.
Alex Bruce, yeah.
But it is strange that friendly games would count towards your ranking and these... ostensibly competitive games, which could, you know, you can qualify for Euro 2020, so they are competitive games, wouldn't count towards your ranking. It's one of the many, if admittedly less damaging, quirks of FIFA.
Well, it seemed to be one of the more appealing aspects of it from a qualification standpoint, is that in that you would be playing teams around you. So if you did beat teams around you, you would see your ranking notionally improved and your qualification groups maybe slightly get easier.
It is odd. So we'll talk to Dan McDonald around 7:30. We'll bring you some of the audio from the Six Nations launch in London this afternoon. Eddie Jones in particular was in fine form. And then we'll talk Mabel Cahill before the football show. So Martin O'Neill was obviously in Switzerland. He penned his contract this week. Tony O'Donoghue, you'll have seen this if you're on social media all afternoon, did an interview with O'Neill. It's about 4 minutes long. The general setup is that there's obviously a long line of journalists or broadcast media, and you get some time with the various managers going through. So O'Neill stopped for RTE. The first 2 minutes of it are fine, standard stuff. It's very friendly. Well, no, it's not very friendly, but it's professional, and there's O'Neill touching on Ryan Giggs as the Welsh manager now. That's kind of interesting, and there'll be a chance for revenge on Denmark, and you know, he uses the word revenge. It's kind of a general chat, and then it really, the last 3 minutes just go just rapidly downhill. So the first sign of trouble is this first clip we'll play, and like, as you'll hear, it's not really an unfair question as such. It's just O'Donoghue, I think, addressing the fallout from the Denmark game.
Regarding the Denmark match, it was said that you were quite stung by the criticism after that game. Is that correct?
I think that you just before we did our interview, you actually said to me, "Hard luck," you know, just before we went on air. And what did you mean by that? You know.
Well, it's very disappointing to go out in a playoff, isn't it?
Yeah, you did say hard luck. You weren't being disingenuous about it, were you?
No, didn't mean to be, no.
No, I didn't. Okay, no. It's interesting you should say hard luck to me beforehand. I assume hard luck actually means tough luck on the whole group, you know. Mm-hmm. So there we are. You know. So anyway.
And then O'Neill goes on to answer the question. Well, he doesn't really actually talk about whether he was stung or not. He goes on to say, "I was happy with the effort of the players."
Mm. So he's been stewing on two words for the past 3 months.
Yeah.
Which seems exceptionally petty.
But I don't understand, what's his issue with Tony O'Donoghue just off camera before the interview starts, as some way of greeting, I suppose, as you would do, saying, yeah, hard luck.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's probably right. Tony's I suppose it's an introduction, isn't it?
You either say one or two things, say hard luck or well played or congratulations.
Or hi.
Or, that's it.
But he's wondering, wasn't disingenuous? Like,
what?
I didn't understand. Yeah. I still don't fully understand.
Well, we know what's happened with previous interviews.
No, but I don't understand there. What's the issue with saying hard luck?
I think the issue being is that, look, you genuinely felt for us, and then he felt as though then he went on to have a total different interview off the back of saying hard luck at the start of that interview. That's the meaning, of course, isn't it? But I personally would just like to see this one be put to bed, because I think we've moved on now from perhaps Martin O'Neill going to Stoke. Now all this agenda, all this sort of, sorry, different scenarios that could have happened. Mm. Now we can perhaps move on. That's what you may be expecting to happen, really, now, certainly into these friendlies. But now all of a sudden, now we've got another issue, haven't we?
Yeah, well, it's not incompatible for, in this instance, or any interview, O'Donoghue to say hard luck before the start of the interview and then ask relevant questions about a 5-1 defeat at home. Like, they're not mutually exclusive.
Well, he obviously feels that the tone of or the line of questioning from Tony hasn't necessarily suited him.
But don't have an issue with the hard luck thing.
Yeah,
like, you can say I didn't like your questions, but saying hard luck off camera, and also I don't know. Would O'Neill love if Tony O'Donoghue was bringing up off camera exchanges? Mm. Maybe he wouldn't. Anyway, so they get through that strange little moment, and then O'Donoghue kind of asks about, well, were you stung by the wider criticism? And O'Neill says, well, you've already asked me that question, and they move on. So obviously O'Neill was tempted, it seemed, by a Premier League job. So Tony O'Donoghue asked him about the whole will he, won't he stay period.
Afterwards, and I suppose you would have found this flattering, that you were the subject of a lot of interest from Premier League clubs. Was that a temptation for you to get back into the game at that level?
No, I'll tell you what might be interesting about that, you know, that the job, I think that the perception of the job that I was doing for the Republic of Ireland, like qualifying for the Euros, getting through in the playoffs, you know, getting through where we were four seeds and then we finished second in the group, actually making the playoffs, obviously the disappointment of Denmark when we were actually really trying to go for it. We had to try and get a couple of goals in the second half, otherwise there was no point. You had no point in sitting back and losing 2-1 in the game. But the perception elsewhere is actually very, very, very positive, unlike yourself.
Well, I wouldn't say it was me or just me by any means. Well, of course.
After the game,
yeah.
You know, when you did say hard luck to me, and then it went. It's just a real verbal attack, wasn't it? You know?
I wouldn't think so, Martin, to be honest with you.
Well, that's, so it's funny. your reaction is totally different to the one. Hence, people asking me about jobs. You know.
Well, you've been offered jobs, which is terrific, and you're staying with the team, which is good
and
as well.
I think you also have to check my record. I think John mentioned this about my record at clubs. I don't actually just disappear after a week.
Which is something that I have pointed out very regularly on radio and television.
This is it. And particularly in a day and age now when managers are coming and going in 5 or 6 or 7 weeks, particularly difficult. I think my record speaks for itself.
Absolutely, it does. No question about that. So when you're looking at...
You've had loads of time. You've had more time than the lads here at the end of the day. And I thank you for your time. All right? Much appreciated.
Is Martin O'Neill aware that these interviews go out to more people than just Tony O'Donoghue? Like, is he aware that he's potentially broadcasting to 3-4 million people?
Of course, yeah.
But then why carry on like a petulant child?
Well, he's clearly unhappy with the line of questioning. He's clearly unhappy. That was probably one of his big bugbearers, probably post that Denmark match. That's the only thing you can think of there.
Is he making that unhappiness clear in A, the right setting, and B, the correct manner?
Well, as I said before, I mean, you would like to think that that certainly could have been... This could be an instance now to put everything that's happened perhaps put to bed, perhaps even sit down, have a phone call with each other, sit down, have a cup of coffee, have a tea, whatever it will be. And whatever's happened has happened. Let's just now move on. Because as you say, it's that negativity that builds around this because of the interviews which have been shown to so many different people. And Joe pointed out at the start, how many people would have viewed that on social media today? There'll be a lot of people that's viewed that. So automatically now there is, again, a negative feeling around these two probably when they come together, and it's not, I don't think it's great for the side. I don't think it is great for them. No, I don't.
It did seem like it was the time to just start the new campaign, move on, and not drag all this stuff up again. Like Tony's question was,
I don't think it affects the side anyway.
Well, no, okay, just to fit, like Tony's question was, if you're saying, well, I saw a few, I think the majority of people thought it was slightly strange behaviour on O'Neill's part on social media. I saw a few people, like someone's texting saying, in my humble opinion, Tony O'Donoghue was reprehensible in his interview, says Mary.
What, there?
I presume so. I don't know. Or maybe the Denmark game. But it predates the Denmark game, what's going on with them. Like, if you remember after the Wales game in Cardiff, when an innocuous enough question was asked of James McLean about the other dairy man beside you who's having a great night, which was O'Neill in that case. O'Neill just put his hand up and said, we're going to finish the interview, and brought McLean away. And that was before the Denmark game. So it predates any great offence caused in the Denmark interview. So I don't think he can fall back on that. But if you just look at the questions on paper there that seemed to draw the strongest reaction, Tony O'Donoghue, it was reported you were stung by the criticism. There's nothing wrong with that question.
That was something Luke Edwards alluded to.
I was going
to
say,
well, yeah.
It was reported in the Daily Telegraph, and Luke basically had spoken to O'Neill.
Yeah.
So it was reported you were stung by the criticism has come from basically the person you're closest to in the media. So it's a chance for you to say, I thought it was a bit harsh, or, you know, on reflection, I understand people are unhappy, but I was disappointed too and I want to move on, as opposed to getting into whatever nonsense they got into there. And also, was it a temptation to get back into Premier League football, was the question. Is that not, can we not ask O'Neill this now?
Having spoken to two Premier League sides.
Yeah, but are we not at a point realistically where the RTE football correspondent, given the last month, can't ask the manager of Ireland, was it a temptation to get back into Premier League football?
It's a fair point, of course it is, yeah.
And that turned into, they're all very positive, unlike yourself.
Yeah.
A verbal attack, your reaction totally different. And Tony's trying to say, I've pointed out that you've had an excellent record at club level. And it ends, you know, while we're wrapping up the interview, we're done. I don't know. I just thought, really, like...
I know. I take your point totally. It's right. I just don't know where it's going to go to from here.
That's the thing. I mean,
that's the problem.
That was not going forward. That was not a difficult interview there, and it turned into something just kind of toxic. So I don't know. I just couldn't believe it went that way. I would have thought, right, new campaign,
clean slate. Here we go.
Yeah,
and why not? Like, everyone just move on. But that ain't happening. It seems anyway.
There's an air of 2002 off this, not obviously with the toxic nature of Keane departing, but I remember that campaign after, for a year, 2004, that Mick McCarthy started, especially with the home game against Switzerland. there was an air around the side, you probably know better than me, an air around the side and an atmosphere around Lands End Road for that Switzerland game that was not good, and it was based around the wider public being unhappy with McCarthy still being
there. Yeah, agree. And after 2012 with Trapattoni, most definitely.
And neither occasion worked in the manager's favour.
No. No, it didn't at all. You spot on with that as well. The only way, it's a simple fact that we all know it is now. We have to now get results. Again, as I said before, I should maybe touched on it, but it won't affect the team, what's going on between Martin O'Neill and Tony O'Donoghue. It simply won't.
They won't
I can
care.
Tell you that now. They will not care. Half of them, probably majority of them, will not even watch that interview unless they see it on social media. That'll be the only way they'll see it, because they certainly won't be watching it on TV.
Yeah.
So that is the only way maybe in for them to see that. So it won't affect them.
No. So let's start the news round. Do you have the dates of those games?
Yeah, the Republic of Ireland will begin that UEFA Nations League campaign away to Wales on September the 6th of this year. The game comes just 11 months after the sides met in Cardiff in their Group D World Cup qualifier. After that follows back-to-back home games with Denmark and then the Welsh on October 13th and 16th respectively. Ireland's group campaign concludes away to Denmark on November the 19th. The sides were drawn together in Group 4 of League B in Switzerland today. Despite one of his pre-contract signing promises being a rejuvenation of the squad, O'Neill says his experimenting with new players will still be confined to friendlies.
I think that we've got some friendly games coming up now. We've got a game in March, and I think that that's the time for us to experiment, you know, try and maybe bring some of the younger players through, and hopefully we've got at least one game against France, I think, in at the end of May, beginning of June time, and the possibility of another game. And I think that those matches then, you use that sort of opportunity. But these games now, the games in September, October, November, as we've just mentioned here, have a significance all of their own, so I think the experimentation might have to disappear.
There's live football this evening.
There is. Manchester City await the winners of tonight's League Cup semi-final second leg at the Emirates. Arsenal and Chelsea goalless from their clash at Stamford Bridge a fortnight ago. The teams are in for Arsenal. David Ospina starts in goal. They then got a back four of Hector Bellerin, Skrojan Mustafi, Lauren Koscielny and Nacho Monreal. In midfield sit Mohamed Elneny and Granit Xhaka, with in front of them Mesut Ozil, Jack Wilshere and Alex Iwobi. In behind, Alexandre Lacazette. For Chelsea, Willie Caballero starts in goal for them. They've got the back three of Cesar Azpilicueta, Andreas Christensen and Antonio Rudiger. Across the midfield, it's Victor Moses, Tomi Bakayoko and N'Golo Kante, with Marcus Alonso on the left-hand side. And then up front, William, Eden Hazard and Pedro.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
Got everything in front of me, so I think I have it. It took me a while to get there.
Okay.
A few of the lads in there earlier on, but I think I've got it yet. The league split up into four different leagues, League A, B, C and D. If you win a group, you automatically get into a playoff for Euro 2020 by winning a group.
What?
Yeah. So if you win your group, so if we had, say, Wales and Northern Ireland, we then, I think it comes down to, so if we win League B, and now not necessarily, if you win all the games, potentially that gives you the chance, you've topped that group. That's how it would work.
So basically the top four teams in each league, so the one from each group, will go forward to the playoffs, assuming they haven't qualified for Euro 2020 via their actual qualifying group.
But regardless of anything, Joe,
not like you can break water
at the end of it. If you top your league, you're going to you'll hit then the playoff system. To win the overall winner, which will be League A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
If then, as I said before, if you win that league, you automatically then qualify. Hit the playoff for the Euros. That's what you get.
When you say winning the league, what do you mean?
You win the League B.
You get one from pot one, one from pot three, and it's a three-team group, and you play them each home and away, and you got four games, and then if we win our league, we get promoted to League A.
I don't understand. So if we win our little group with the other two teams, let's say it's
not necessarily that. If you win your league,
I was going to say. So if we win our league, say we've Northern Ireland and Wales, and we come out of that group.
Say you win all four games. That's the way that you can maybe explain it a little bit. But if you win all four games, you give yourself a great chance of winning the league, because it's going to come down to goal difference and everything will probably.
So what do you have to do to win your league? I get we have a little group within a league. What do you have to do to win the league? To win League B. You don't know. No, that's fine. You don't know.
Yeah, you killed me there. No, let's not go into
that. No, you screwed up.
I'm still right when I said essentially. I know exactly what I meant.
It's crystal clear. Dan McDonald is on the line from Switzerland. Good evening.
Hi, I'm actually confused after hearing that.
Dan, don't mind these. Don't mind these, honestly. Don't confuse yourself with it. Honestly, it's fine.
That's the edited version of what happened last night.
It all makes perfect sense.
We were just, not to get too sidetracked, because obviously the important stuff is the football. We just mentioned the Tony O'Donoghue-Martin O'Neill exchange, so any hope of a clean slate, Dan, was quickly crushed in overwhelming fashion. You were nearby when this exchange was happening. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. Was he in general good form when he was speaking to you guys?
Yeah, no, I was there for the whole exchange, all right. I mean, it was the last interview of Martin O'Neill's day, and I think we might have had his first one, unusually, from the sort of press print lad's point of view. I mean, we had 15 minutes with him. It was pretty okay. But the one thing that is clear from everything today is that, unfortunately, the spikiness about the criticism that he received after the 5-1 is still there. If maybe we thought that today would be a sense of moving beyond that and moving past it and accept, I suppose, you know, almost not let bygones be bygones, admit it was a bad night and move on with it. Maybe the fact we've drawn Denmark doesn't help, because we're going to play them again twice more this year. But I still think the unhappiness with the criticism still exists with Martin O'Neill. He still probably can't understand the extent of it, because he still feels he's done a very good job, and as simple as that. And I don't think that atmosphere is going to change dramatically. Unfortunately, you play Denmark twice. What are the questions going to be?
Sure,
you know, revenge. Yeah. Let's go. Let's play them again. It's probably not a great draw from the perspective of moving on with a clean slate.
And Tony O'Donoghue asked, it was reported you were stung by the criticism, which was certainly a line which appeared in that Daily Telegraph piece. So, and like O'Neill turned that back on O'Donoghue and said, "Well, that was you, basically. That was all you and your interview." But when you brought up that issue of the wider criticism with O'Neill in the print section, I don't know. You're probably under some kind of embargo. But did he engage? Will we see him engaging with that potential point in the papers tomorrow? Did he accept he was stung in some broad way?
Yeah, I mean, I think he is. Yeah, I think it's clear that he was stung, and he has addressed that point. But as I said, his main view is that, on one hand, he takes the criticism, and on the other hand, he still feels that it was over the top, I guess. And that is just his opinion. I mean, maybe we all need to move on from it. I accept there are people who are fatigued by that whole angle of things. But I guess, you know, without overanalyzing things too much, the interactions that the manager has with the press is often all that the public sees. And it just presents an image of a slightly defensive camp when you have that stuff today. I don't think it's hugely beneficial. We know what happened. It wasn't great. But if we've got 2.5 years left of this, I think there needs to be a different mood around it. And this one night is just threatening to, to take the whole ship off course.
Yeah, Dan, it just seemed to me like this is probably his time now to get everything off his chest. Did it seem that way to you today, particularly? We've all seen the Tony O'Donoghue one, but even with you lads, was it just his chance just to get everything off his chest and almost now he can move on from it? Was there any suggestion of that?
Well, it's a strange thing, because John Delaney did mention last week that he felt that all the issues would be addressed today and we would move on. But when that was raised with Martin O'Neill, I think he felt that there was still stuff he wanted to go back to on another day about maybe the reasons that he stayed. So maybe he wasn't fully maybe briefed with the memo that this was going to be the day where we really moved, you know, as you said, get everything off the chest and move on to the future. Yeah. I mean, it's not always ideal after a draw and standing up, and it's not necessarily a comfortable round table discussion, you know, where you have this forum to do that. Maybe that plays into it, but it's still lingering a small bit. There's still questions that are unanswered. He's maybe touched on it a bit more in detail with us compared to the short clip with RTE. But I still feel there's more to discuss about the everything that's happened over the last couple of months. We don't maybe have that closure that I honestly thought that we might have after today, to some degree. I still feel people's views on O'Neill haven't been changed by today. I think there's still fans out there that are maybe a bit miffed, fans out there who want us all to move on. But yeah, maybe not satisfactory in terms of drawing a line under the whole thing, that's for sure.
So you mentioned the unfortunate aspect of the Denmark coming out of the hat is that it brings up questions and memories of the 5-1 night in particular. They also happen to be a very good team, and Wales are pretty good either, are pretty good as well, rather. So, like, with regard to the type of group we could have got, is this about as tough as we could have been dealt?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Denmark were actually in the pot below us, and they were definitely, you know, they're definitely the best team in that pot. Yeah, Wales was tough. I mean, the other options we could have got were much of a muchness, but I think the overall combination is a very tough group. Mm. Yeah, I mean, they're going to be proper tests come the autumn, and I think maybe you might have referenced it earlier, that there's a need to just get some good results and just move on from the 5-1. Never mind all the other noise, just good results in a football game, you know. And these are tough games. I mean, the way it pans out, there's now, you know, first away to Wales, as you might mention, and then a double header in Dublin in October at home to Wales and Denmark.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be significant. Whatever about teasing out what the games are worth in the bigger scheme and all the permutations, you know, that's going to be a big week just to see how the public is, how everyone is, and for the confidence of the group to get a big home win against a good opponent, it could be beneficial. But that's tough. There was easier combinations in there, and this isn't a sort of an easy parachute into life after the disappointment of November. Yeah. These would be tough matches.
Yeah, Dan, do you get the impression that it's what Martin O'Neill wanted, the competitiveness of these friendly internationals, so-called friendly internationals, should I say?
Yeah, I think he probably... There was a sense after that he probably will embrace it. I think, you know, he may not experiment as much as people might think. I think just being there and I mean, he'll have his own scores to settle, I guess, with Denmark, and there's a little edge obviously in the Welsh games with the Seamus Coleman angle even, and you know, the Wales may be unhappy about aspects of the game in October. I mean, these are going to be proper atmospheres and proper internationals, and maybe when he has so long to wait from one big game to the next, I think he's probably happier with that than he might have been, but I don't know, sort of lower profile games against Slovakia or someone like that. I think he's probably happier this way, but it can bring its own pressures if things go badly. So we're all going to be watching this with interest, because you know, there is that window after the Nations League to see where you are going into the Euros, and if things go badly and we end up as third seeds, there will be pressure. So these matches might not be as irrelevant as you might have thought initially.
Mm. Yeah, Dan, you mentioned there about the experimentation. I think John Delaney certainly mentioned that last week, a couple of his comments saying that there would be one or two new faces, or certainly more different faces coming into the squad now. Did Martin O'Neill talk about that today? Because you mentioned there that perhaps, given the competitiveness of these friendlies now, we might not necessarily see some of the players that we maybe envisage seeing.
Yeah, we probably didn't go into it as much as we might have, but there was it was touched upon that I think it's fairly clear that he is going to, with a view to this game in Turkey in March and the training camp there, I think he'll loosen his attitude towards maybe bringing lads away. I think he's always had the view that you shouldn't just throw around caps for the sake of it and have all these one cap wonders. I think he will experiment in March. I think he will experiment maybe in the summer, depending on what the games may be, although I can't imagine him putting out an inexperienced side in Paris away to France, because he probably can't take a hammer in still. But I think we'll see a bit in Turkey still. I think that will be a squad with a view to the longer term future. He sort of gave the impression that would be the plan.
And one last point then, I think we all, after Kev's explanation last night, know certainly that potentially there's a playoff place for Euro 2020 available here if things go extremely well. So we'll put that on ice for a second. You mentioned their seedings for the Euro 2020 qualification group, which will kick off in March. So in what way will that be affected potentially by what's going to happen in the autumn?
Yeah, well, basically at the moment we ended up in League B because of our ranking within the UEFA coefficient.
Yeah.
These games that we have this September, October, November, we will either, you know, we will stay inside the top 20 places, or we will move outside them. At the moment, we're inside the top 20, which means second seeds.
Mm.
If we get bad results, we'll drop outside the top 20 because we're pretty much at the cut line.
Okay.
So we will be third seeds.
Okay, so we don't have much leeway to stay second seeds then.
No, I think that's going to be a these results are going to matter to us in that context. And yeah, for in terms of the draw, this is significant.
Okay,
brilliantly explained, Dan. Well done.
Simple as that. Simple as that, Gavin.
Dan, thanks very much.
Thanks, guys. Chat to you.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
We do want to turn to the Phil Neville story. So we've got Louise Taylor of The Guardian on the line. Arsenal 1, Chelsea 1 after 54 minutes on the clock, by the way, still in the semi-final game tonight. So Louise Taylor of The Guardian is on the line. Phil Neville got the England job this week, the women's English national team coach job. There were questions over the transparency of the appointment and his credentials initially, and then in the last 24 hours, some less than ideal tweets, sexist jokes, one joke about domestic abuse, have surfaced, and so the FA have come under some attack, and Neville himself has deleted his social media. Louise, you might begin by just summing up the context, how we got here to Phil Neville's appointment.
Yes, well, the FA have been talking to Phil Neville since about Christmas time, because their initial shortlisted candidates all rejected the job, and the majority of them, it appears, pulled out of the process for personal reasons when they realised the depth of the background checks. Because I think you remember Mark Sampson was actually sacked for what was termed unacceptable behaviour with a player in a former job. Mm. Now, this was, broadly speaking, a six-month relationship with a player when he was manager at Bristol Academy, now Bristol City, who was not even in the first team and who was over 18. I mean, he was in his 20s at the time. So this set quite a high bar, because the game has only recently turned fully professional, the women's game. And so in the past, when it was part-time or perhaps moving to semi-professional, these relationships between coaches and players were surprisingly common, because in many ways it was almost a hobby activity. Mm. And there weren't clear demarcation lines. So the shortlisted candidates turned the FA down. Somebody like John Herdman, who'd probably emerged as the real favourite, he might have taken the job, but he was the Canada women's coach, and he was then shifted to the Canada men's coach, and he loves living in Vancouver, so he took that option.
Yeah.
So the FA were then struggling to get somebody. I mean, which I find slightly amazing when you think it's a big world out there, and there's some very, very qualified coaches, both women and men. Mm. But Phil Neville was part of their player to coach program, and he has his admirers inside the FA, and so he was approached and gradually warmed to the idea. He does hold a pro license certificate, but he's never been a frontline manager and has had zero experience in the women's game. Mm. Unless you count his hotel football in Manchester, being involved in staging a lingerie football match, don't ask. So he eventually gets the job.
A lingerie football match?
Yes. Now this, I mean, in fairness to Phil Neville, he was actually helping his brother coach Valencia at the time, and he co-owns the hotel with a few former Manchester United teammates, and there's also business partners. And I think it was a group who play in hot pants and crop tops wanted some publicity, and they staged this lingerie football match on the roof of hotel football in Manchester. Clearly, because it's not great for body image for girls and women. The FA don't allow lingerie football to take place on FA-affiliated grounds. But I think that's probably a slightly tenuous stick to beat Phil Neville with.
So, Louise, if I could just jump in there for a second, because Martin Glenn and the FA have released a statement this afternoon just clarifying the process as best they can. They've confirmed that the Rooney Rule was not in place at the time of this process. It seems they identified 145 candidates. Then they went to 47 on a long list, and Sue Campbell, the FA director of women's football, picked out six on a shortlist, two of them female. And as you mentioned, those extensive background checks seem to put off, according to the FA statement, those extensive background checks seem to put off two of the candidates. Then subsequently a third one pulled out, and then the internal candidate pulled out for personal reasons. And Martin Glenn in the FA statement says that efforts to return to other candidates proved unsuccessful for similar reasons. And it was at that point, he says, that Sue Campbell identified Phil. That just strikes me as very odd, that efforts to return to other candidates proved unsuccessful for similar reasons. They identify 145 initially. They get down to 47 on a long list. The background checks seemingly are so rigorous and extensive in certain places that a number of candidates pull out. They seem to miss several of the Phil Neville tweets, which is ironic. So that Phil Neville suddenly emerged, poof, out of thin air here as a great idea. I don't know if that's an overly satisfactory explanation from Martin Glenn or overly transparent.
No, I mean, I would be very surprised if 47 people were concerned about what background checks would throw up.
Louise, what background checks do they actually do?
Well, I think, I mean, as I mentioned before, I think there's been a history of players and coaches having relationships in the game when it was a part-time game before professionalisation came. Many of these coaches have been in the game for many years, since perhaps their 20s and early 30s. Mm. And they were perhaps, you could say, they were concerned about a whistleblower pointing out some past liaison. And because of the reason that they sacked Mark Sampson, which was this six-month relationship with a player at Bristol, that set the bar perhaps unfeasibly high.
Okay.
I mean, he was in his 20s at the time. The girl was over 18. She wasn't in the team. So it wasn't perhaps crime of the century. So this I think, has unnerved some people involved, that they thought they would perhaps be vulnerable to whistleblowing. That said, I can't believe that 47 of them were all in this situation.
Yeah.
And it has been suggested that perhaps there was a higher standard in terms of football to applied to female candidates than to perhaps Phil Neville. And they were wanting only female candidates who had really won things at the top of the international game. Now, that's quite a rarefied field, and some of these women and men have other offers, good jobs, and that they perhaps would have legitimate reasons for turning England down. For instance, John Herdman was obviously given the men's job with Canada.
Yeah.
Serena Weigman, the Holland coach, she perhaps wants to stay and try and win the World Cup, etc. But Jill Ellis, the Portsmouth-born US coach, she perhaps wanted to remain in the US. But I also gather that some women who were pretty well qualified at a slightly lower level were overlooked and were weeded out at this stage. I mean, women with years of experience coaching in the women's game, and perhaps internationally as well. So Phil Neville, they've said, great, we'll appoint you because you've got potential, and we like this idea.
Yeah.
But I think for a woman to meet their standard, it would have had to be the bar was again raised much, much higher.
Okay, higher threshold. Because I saw you in an earlier report for The Guardian make the point, it is understood that Neville's name was initially suggested to the FA in a light-hearted manner by a well-known broadcaster at a drinks reception.
This is disputed.
Okay.
Although I've never had a call from the FA disputing it, and I have heard it from more than one source, including the broadcaster. But the official line is that Sue Campbell took the initiative and decided, because Neville was on the coach to the player to coach program. But I think that they were perhaps slightly desperate and scratching their heads, which again is puzzling when it's supposed to have been a worldwide search that they couldn't identify someone.
Mm.
I mean, there was clearly a preference for an English or certainly British coach, which narrowed the field. But then again, I mean, yeah. it's surprising because, okay, you could have somebody, a male coach, without experience of the female game. I mean, for instance, if Rafa Benitez decided he was fed up with Newcastle and Mike Ashley mm-hmm. and decided he wanted to manage England women, the FA would have been fools not to listen to him.
Yeah, but you're saying Neville doesn't really tick either box. It's not like he's got a knowledge of the women's game or that he's done something extraordinary in the men's game. Like, by the same token, we've seen Ryan Giggs get a job without much experience. Mark Hughes before him at the Welsh job. We've seen Pep Guardiola being given a chance. There is an argument if you see a candidate with the right qualities, potentially. And Neville has worked behind the scenes at Manchester United, Everton, England under-21s, Valencia. There is an argument that if you identify someone with the right qualities, you give them their chance. But I appreciate the point that his expertise would have been in the men's game and his knowledge would have been in the men's game. Presumably he could get up to speed. That's maybe a subjective point. I appreciate what you're saying about the 47 candidates in that long list, all of them presumably couldn't have become uninterested in the job. Where it gets very tricky now for Martin Glenn and the FA are the Phil Neville tweets which emerge. Considering the delicate nature of this position given the Samson affair, Neville 2011 tweeted, I don't know where he had been, but he said to everybody on Twitter, "Relax, I'm back, chilled, just battered the wife, feel better now." 2012 he posted, "Morning men, a couple of hours of cricket before work sets me up nicely for the day." And then some people said, why did he say morning men, not women? He said, "When I said morning men, I thought the women would have been busy preparing breakfast, getting kids ready, making the beds. Sorry, morning women." These are clearly jokes, obviously. They're pretty crap jokes to start with. And also suddenly deeply, deeply inappropriate for the women's manager to have made. He's deleted his Twitter account. The FA say they knew of some of the tweets, but not all of them. You'd like a bit more detail there. I can imagine Martin Glenn and everybody in the FA putting their palms to their forehead when this emerged.
Yes, I mean, slightly ironic when they'd been so hot on their background check. Mm. They clearly hadn't trawled through his Twitter account sufficiently.
This wasn't exactly the FBI level of interrogation here.
No, I mean, they were there in plain sight. I mean, they were historic tweets and perhaps didn't reflect current thinking. I mean, they were very, very silly. I mean, in context, the domestic violence tweet, which is ostensibly the most disturbing, was a joke exchange with his wife, and the equality tweet was a joke exchange with his twin sister Tracy, who's the head coach of the England women's netball team. But I mean, what they do is they open a window onto a rather old-fashioned looking mindset. I mean, I think he's going to get quite a culture shock when he really gets to know the England women's footballers, and I think it's perhaps going to be a different type of woman from those he's encountered before.
I think interesting enough as well, Tracy, Phil's wife, has come out this afternoon as well and offered some sort of support to him via Instagram this afternoon. But there's a statement released from Kick It Out this afternoon as well, Louise, and they were actually asking the question of whether Phil Neville should actually be charged for these tweets, given the fact is that they've charged players quite recently for historic tweets that they've put out there. Do you envisage that will be the case at all?
Well, they've actually said, the FA have actually come out and said that they won't be charging him because happily the comments don't meet the threshold needed for to trigger their disciplinary processes, whatever the threshold is. So I think that would have been a grotesque farce, wouldn't it? You know, if they'd appointed this new manager and then immediately had to charge him. But I think that they've also said that they're going to perhaps offer, and as part of his induction, they're going to offer in him an educational process about their standards and meeting their standards, and he's taken the decision that he's going to leave social media alone, which is probably wise for everybody. But I mean, it was just a real situation comedy, yeah. Comedy moment, these tweets suddenly appearing. And of course, their announcement was supposed to be excellent PR. I mean, And another of the ironies is that I think there was a feeling that Phil Neville would be a good appointment in PR terms and maybe generate more interest in the women's game. I mean, I personally don't necessarily agree with that, but there was a feeling that he would raise the profile. Well, he's certainly done that, but not in the way that they quite intended.
Mm. So, I mean, I guess I understand what they mean in the raise the PR way. I mean, he's a well-known figure. Lots of people will be interested to see how he's getting on. Like, so this is kind of a very tricky one for the FA now. They pretty much have said they're going to stick by Neville. Unless more tweets emerge, this shouldn't get a whole lot worse for them. I mean, it's been pretty bad. I wonder how much pressure they under. Are they coming under pressure?
Well, I think that Phil Neville has some friendships and long-standing relationships with some quite senior journalists across the national newspapers. I mean, he genuinely is supposed to be. I've never met Phil Neville, but he's supposed to be an engaging, likeable man. And I think his friends will rally round and perhaps say this Twitter storm's a bit out of proportion.
Mm.
There's a mixed reaction, I think, in women's football circles between. I mean, it depends on how the players react when they actually work with him. I think there's perhaps a willingness to be receptive. I mean, the last thing the FA would want to do is make another change. My instinct is that unless something else extraordinary emerges, they will ride this out. And I think they're already starting to do that. And I'd be interested to see tomorrow's papers. I think the majority of them will probably be fairly supportive for him. I think they'll wheel him out for the official unveiling quite soon, probably early next week. I mean, he's in La Manga, where the England squad are having a winter training camp at the moment. And I would imagine that he'll, in one sense, try and make light of the tweets while at the same time acknowledging the potential seriousness and regretting his use of language and interpretation, etc. So I would be very surprised if they don't manage to ride this one out.
Louise, just one last general question. The conversations that are going on in the women's game, is there a broad consensus either way as to whether managers should be male or increasingly female with the advent of professionalism? Is there a sense that real success would be if a Rafa Benitez decided, well, I'm going to take up a women's position, or is there no consensus whatsoever on the direction for the women's game?
Well, I think there's a division of opinion.
Right.
I think the England players were very much the best person for the job.
Mm-hmm.
They were open-minded. I'm sure if Rafa Benitez had wanted the job, they would have been overjoyed.
Yeah.
And I think it would have perhaps kicked the game on and pulled it up to a higher level. I think there's also an argument for female coaches, and you have to say that all the major tournaments and Olympics since 2000, only one has been won by a male coach. So the women's coaches actually have a monopoly on the biggest prizes. There's also a sense that that perhaps some men who can't get jobs in the male game, or like Phil Neville, perhaps want a stepping stone into it, are using the women's game. Then you've got the issue that because the coaching badges, like the pro license, are really expensive to finance, that there's relatively only a handful in this country of qualified women coaches. So that does create an imbalance, and it is going to take time to catch up. There's also the factor that for women with children, it's not always a child-friendly job. So that's another factor. But there's certainly enough women coaches out there. I think this time, a lot of people would have welcomed, say Laura Harvey, who decided to stay in the States with Utah Royals. She used to coach Arsenal. But I think equally, had John Herdman, the concert-born Canada coach, got the job, I think he would have been a popular appointment as well.
Okay.
But, you know, he had a major body of work in the women's game. He'd done brilliantly in setting up the New Zealand women before Canada. So it's an open mind, but I think I think there was a bit of shock that it was an unqualified candidate. I mean, it's a slightly left-field appointment. I mean, Phil Neville could prove absolutely brilliant, and they sweep all the prizes before them. But if that happens, I mean, my feeling would be it's probably more luck than judgment on Martin Glenn's part at the FA.
Louise, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Off the Ball.
In association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
Well, Arsenal have taken a 2-1 lead over Chelsea on the night and on aggregate, Kevin Coban. Xhaka with the goal.
Yeah, Xhaka with the goal. It was a breakaway down the right-hand side. And he was actually looking for a pullback. He was looking for a pullback to the edge of the penalty area. And I think the ball deflected off Rudiger into the path of Xhaka. And Xhaka just nipped in front of Caballero and just stabbed it in. So, yeah, Arsenal in front. I mean, I said before, it's been a relentless pace. It's been a good tempo to the match. Good watch, actually. And Arsenal got themselves in front, yeah.
One of those intermittent nights where Arsenal put in a big performance against a big team and you think they've cracked it.
Yeah, I know, that's the problem, isn't it? That's the problem that you'll always find. I mean, particularly after the big win at the weekend, scoring those four goals early against Palace at the weekend as well, Sanchez leaving, Mkhitaryan coming in, looking to get Aubameyang. There's a lot of expectation around Arsenal here now through this window. So, essentially, it's all looking good for them, yeah.
Yeah, famous last words. 13 minutes to play at the Emirates. They're 2-1 up on aggregate and on the night, obviously, it was nil all at Stamford Bridge. Manchester City waiting in the final. Tim Vickery, meanwhile, is on the line from Brazil. Evening, Tim.
Good evening. Can the Arsenal player squeeze one in from there? Xhaka can. Xhaka can.
Well,
the old ones are always the best.
There you go. Is that the stuff you come out with on Brazilian TV as well, Tim?
It is.
Yeah,
it is. And
classic
no one understands
lines.
Me there either.
So we wanted to talk to you about something I don't think we've talked to you about, or certainly I don't remember it if we have. I'm not even overly familiar with the format of all this. So the state championships seem to be at the heart of Brazilian club football's problems. For me to clumsily sum up the situation, ahead of the real season getting underway, in Brazil they have these state championships. The various states around the country play what seem to be these very protracted, glorified warm season or pre-season friendly type things. Like the Rio State one has about 16 teams in a round robin hellhole, and it goes on for months and months. Like the actual season's not going to start for another 2 or 3 months.
No, and the league season starts in May. Right. The National League starts in May. So until then, we're wasting our time really. To explain this in its most simple form. It's designed to fail. It's a system which is designed to fail. Brazilian football is not run on business lines, and it's become an export industry. Last year, nearly 2,000 players left Brazil. So the whole thing has become an export industry where people make money. Agents make money, players make money, the families of players make money. The families of players are often the worst elements in there because they're desperate for the money. You know, when a big money bid comes in from Ukraine or somewhere or wherever, they're just looking at the money that they're going to make. But also club directors make money. And while you have a structure which operates below its potential, that means that there's always the possibility, there's always the necessity to sell a player. And when you're selling players, that means there are opportunities for money to be diverted into private bank accounts. And if you look back a decade, it was common then, you know, when Brazil was going through an economic boom and investing in a World Cup, Europe in economic terms was struggling. It was common then to read the idea that in a few years' time, the Brazilian league would be on the same level, financially speaking, as the big European leagues. In fact, the opposite has happened. The gap has never been wider. And that's one of the reasons for that is the people running Brazilian football, many of them seem to have a vested interest in its failure. The calendar makes no sense whatsoever. These state championships, they do have historical importance. Brazil is a huge country. It's a giant country. Didn't really have a proper national league since until 1971. So the roots of the game are of rivalries inside a city. It's not a kind of Real Madrid against Barcelona thing. It's teams from inside the same city. So historically, these championships, one for each state. Brazil is divided into 27 states. Historically, they're important. These days, they have no importance whatsoever. You mentioned 16 teams there in the Rio First Division.
Yeah.
The vast majority of them don't really exist in professional terms. They don't have supporters. They don't represent anyone. So for a massive club, to spend months playing on a league basis against this type of opposition. It doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. If it happens on a cup basis, there's a charm to it because there's always a chance of the underdog winning, of a Sutton United beating Leeds or whatever. But on a league basis, it makes no sense. It wastes everyone's time and it ensures that Brazilian football operates below potential, which is one of the reasons that you lot over there get to enjoy so many of the best Brazilians.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. Like, it's amazing that this persists, notwithstanding your point about this being an export business at this stage. But even we were looking at Fluminense, Botafogo, that derby, the Grandad Classic, even the recent
indeed.
One. 7,000 people bothered to turn up to watch this derby game. It dates back to 103 years, this rivalry. But a lot of tourists made up that 7,000. It was nil all in the Maracanã. And you've got players who are nowhere near peak fitness.
No.
What are you trying to do with the calendar?
With that calendar, with playing a national league of 20 teams and these state championships first, you're trying to fit 5 litres into a 3-litre bottle. So there's no real time for a proper pre-season. The players are back in action less than 2 weeks after of pre-season training of less than 2 weeks. There's no pauses for FIFA dates. So imagine if you're a Brazilian first division club and you're paying good money to some of your best players, and then they're going off for 10 days representing their national teams, and the league doesn't pause. It makes absolutely no sense. And that nil-nil, and that was a long, long nil-nil draw in the Maracanã. It's one of those things where, you know, the game starts at 5 o'clock. You look at your watch 15 minutes later, 2 hours later, and it's 5:15.
Yeah.
However, just to balance that out, just to perhaps ram home the importance of local rivalries in South America, there was one 2 nights ago in Uruguay, the big local derby in Uruguay, Peñarol against Nacional. Now, this was a genuine pre-season friendly. Nothing at stake. It's a pre-season friendly. 4 players sent off. Last night, I was watching one from Colombia, the Cali derby, America against Deportivo Cali. It's a pre-season friendly. 4 players sent off. I remember being in the stadium for that one in Cali nearly 10 years ago for a competitive league game. And just a riot started. The game couldn't get anywhere near the end of the game. It was just the police went in and the tear gas was all over the place. And it ended up stopping not only the game, but more or less the entire city. The riot just spread throughout the entire city. So sometimes these local derbies in badly organised calendars, these local derbies can be soporific affairs. Other times they can raise the temperature level a little bit too high.
Tim, just in relation to that, you're saying the Brazilian league being that feeder league. I believe it was an 18% increase in export right. players export from 2016 last year. Would I be right in saying that this would be down to the player ownership, agents owning the players, and basically they get the rights early? Because I know that it's certainly happened in certainly getting players into Portugal and to other leagues around the world from Brazil, where they would own 50% share in the club or even up to 100% share of the club in buying the player initially. Is that still exists then in Brazil? Yes.
Yeah, it does. There are attempts are being made to try and limit this, but they haven't been entirely successful, really, because there's always a way around this kind of thing. It reflects, I think, the weak position of the clubs, because the clubs, they're always looking to pay the wage bill, not from last month, but the month before. So what do you do? How do you do that? Now, if you've got a player, you've got a player who you reckon it might be sold in a couple of years, well, you sell 50% of him now, and his ownership becomes a kind of pizza patchwork, and that way you have enough money to pay your short-term obligations, but it makes it harder to pay the long-term, because when the time comes to sell him, you only get half of the player.
Yeah, so just what I say, so essentially then the clubs then, as you say, they're losing out long-term. They're not getting the first share of the money or the distribution of the money that's actually been brought into the league then. Is that's fair to say then, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the Brazilian clubs have adjusted very badly to freedom of contract. I haven't adjusted well to that at all. And you don't have to go back that far to a time when there was no freedom of contract and it didn't. The clubs could go months without paying their players, but they could still retain their registration. Once freedom of contract has come in, that's exposed the weak position and the bad management of the clubs.
Yeah, so the players in general then, certainly at a young age then, it's the dream now then, I suppose, is to play for a Barcelona, a Real Madrid, or certainly one of the big European clubs rather than play for one of the big Brazilian clubs. Would that be right?
It's amazing how quickly that's changed. There's a quite near where I live, there's a free football school, lots of promising youngsters, some of whom have actually gone to Europe. And the youngsters in, say, 20 years ago, when I went to talk to them, The dream was still to play for the big local clubs. That's what they wanted to do. You fast forward that one, just a few years into the globalized era, the dream is now Real Madrid or Barcelona. Maybe one of the Italian clubs, perhaps now some of the English clubs as well. And the Premier League plays very big over here, but nothing really competes with the glamour of Real Madrid and Barcelona.
Is the price of a Brazilian player then still, in your opinion, or would it be considered in Brazil a fair price then?
Well, it depends on the basis of comparison. And European clubs will pay more for a Brazilian player than they will for a player from Colombia, for example. But they'll play a lot less, usually, for a Brazilian player than they would for a Brazilian who's gone to Europe. Take the example of Malcolm of Bordeaux, who's been linked with Arsenal, has been linked with Tottenham. Very interesting little left-footed winger, a player who's developing very, very nicely. But the amount of money that you'd have to pay for him now that he's been in French football for 2 years, is far, far more than the amount of money that Bordeaux had to pay for him when they took him out of Brazilian football as a teenager.
So just to round this off and so I can get my head around this, because this is, I don't know how familiar you are with GAA over here, Tim, but we have some fairly odd fixture situations, and I think actually this Brazilian one may
I was thinking trump exactly them all. The same thing before, John.
We have some mad pre-season tournaments over here, let me tell you. So there's 27 states, and you said the Brazilian national league didn't really get up and running until 1971. I presume pre that it was more of a golden era for these state championships, but I presume once 1971 and the league got up and running in the 70s, these state championships became almost instantly redundant. Like, I mean, it sounds like they're just a horror show at the moment.
They have a historical importance, I came over here in 1994, and that, I think, was a decisive moment, because in 1994, Brazil did away with hyperinflation. And up until that point, the prices were changing every day. And that meant, from the point of view of the clubs, you could meet your obligations just by paying late, you know, because things are getting cheaper essentially every day.
Yeah.
So, you know, that amount of wages that you agreed last year, now it's worth much, much less. So you just hang on a few months and pay, and that's taken your debt away. From 1994, I think then the state championships started to be revealed as the emperor's new clothes. And when I started going on Brazilian TV, you know, in the last like 10, 15 years, I've always been railing against these state championships. At first, they used to look at me like I had two heads.
Right.
You know, like, how can you possibly say this? This is our tradition. This is vital to the tradition of our game. Now, I think a majority would probably agree with me.
Okay, very interesting. Tim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Tim Vickery there, as ever, from Brazil. Still Arsenal 2, Chelsea 1 into the last minute.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Watch live Allianz League's GAA action this weekend on the AIR Sport Pack with a Dublin hurling and football doubleheader at Croke Park.
This is News Talk.
We're into the last 60 seconds, 45 seconds even to be more exact, between Arsenal and Chelsea. 2-1 Arsenal.
Yeah, Eden Hazard's just put a brilliant ball into the penalty area as well. It goes to show, doesn't it, Hazard? We spoke about it at the top of the show. Hazard was playing tonight as a number 9 himself, scored a really good goal. But they are seriously lacking up front. It looks as though, as it's turned out today, that the Dzeko deal, who's played for Roma tonight, coincidentally, the Roma deal, he could be done.
Right.
And they do need something different. They definitely needed a second striker, because he clearly doesn't fancy Batshuayi. And tonight, they've fallen short maybe many areas, but credit to Arsenal. What a touch that was as well. Credit Arsenal, they've just got a corner here now, Chelsea, in the last minute of the game. This will probably be the last moment of this game.
There's an Arsenal fan saying, please stop saying credit to Arsenal before the game's up.
Yeah, maybe you're right there. Maybe you're right, totally, yeah.
Texting on the Phil Neville piece we did with Louise Taylor, women's or men's football, are the principles of the game not the same? If women want to be treated equally, what's wrong with the man being in charge of the team? Well, I don't think the issue is a man with Neville. The issue was that he has no real knowledge of the women's game, the players. It's gone full time, Arsenal are through. But then, like, I do think Phil Neville, with his experience in the game, albeit in the men's grade, will very quickly get to grips with what players he has available to them. He can watch tapes of them very quickly, get a look at them in training.
Yeah, great.
I don't really see him maybe not being fully familiar with the English setup as being
a big issue. No, but I'd feel maybe as well, and Louise Taylor touched on it in her piece as well. Has he done his groundwork in the league? Has he done his served his apprenticeship in many respects within the women's game, which he hasn't? There are people who would, as she would feel as well, and many I'm sure would feel within women's football, that, that feel as though they're better qualified or in a better position to take that job.
Certainly initially, yeah. I mean, he may well do a very good job.
Yeah.
So on the Martin O'Neill, Tony O'Neill thing, so we won't labour this, I'm conscious of that, but lots of texts come in on it when you mention it. Two completely opposite views, for instance, sum up the reaction you get. Somebody says, Neil, that Tony trying to wind up the interviewee to make himself famous when it should be about the subject without winding him up. I don't think you could listen to that today and say that he was trying to wind him up,
no,
to be honest.
I don't think so.
I don't see it. Like, what the questions were so fair. Absolutely not today. And then someone else, Martin O'Neill, really let himself down today. Where does his animosity towards Tony O'Donoghue stem from?
Yeah, well, I think personally where it stems from, I feel as though that he's getting word back from what's been said on the RTÉ panel, and his Tony O'Donoghue then is coming out with his questioning, line of questioning, and he feels as though that line of questioning is coming from the RTÉ panel. So he's directly hitting back at Tony O'Donoghue rather than hitting back at what's been said up in the studio. I'd feel that's the only way.
Yeah.
He's touched on it himself in the past about what's been said in the studio, Martin O'Neill. So it obviously affects him and it offends him, and he's not happy with it.
Okay. So that's us pretty much done for this evening. Tom Dunn is on the way. OTB AM 7:45 as usual tomorrow morning. The lads have Shane Stapleton in talking hurling ahead of the league getting underway. And also you may have seen Gary O'Toole this morning talking about the George Gibney situation. There's a follow-up piece to that tomorrow morning with the journalist Irvin Muchnick, who has done a lot of work on sex scandals generally in US sport. And he's also looked into the George Gibney situation, so he's going to fill in the lads on what he's found out about it or what he's made of what's happened there. So that will be well worth tuning into tomorrow, 7:45 a.m. start as usual for OTB AM. And then Nathan and Kev, are you here tomorrow? Nathan and Kev here on the radio, 7 o'clock tomorrow. We have Sunday, February 25th, Man City Arsenal in the Carabao Cup confirmed. We'll see you tomorrow. Good luck.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.